Welcome to Brainstorm, Decoding Depression, where we will dig into discussions about mood disorders. We're here to change the way we think and talk about depression in an accessible, approachable way with a leading expert in the field. No topic is off limits. Coming to you from Dallas, Texas, this is Brainstorm.
The opinions expressed are our own and do not reflect those of UT Southwestern, the O'Donnell Brain Institute in the UT system, or the state. Welcome to another illuminating episode of Brainstorm, Decoding Depression. I'm your guide, Harmony Hilton. Joining me here is Dr. Madhukar Trivedi, the Director of the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care at UT Southwestern, and Dr. Samantha Melser Brody, the Director of University of North Carolina Center for Women's Mood Disorder, who is also the Asad Maimandi Distinguished Professor and Chair. Welcome, Dr. Melser Brody. We are so happy to speak with you. Would you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background?
Well, thank you for having me today. I'm very happy to be here. I'm a reproductive psychiatrist and have directed the UNC Center of Women's Mood Disorder and founded the perinatal psychiatry program many years ago. And I am currently the chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I've been a passionate advocate and investigator and clinician in perinatal depression.
Well, thank you for that introduction and for sharing and for the important work you're doing. And to get us started, we ask all our guests these two important but simple questions to kind of contextualize and provide insight for the entire discussion. So today we are talking about celebrating women who tell our mental health stories, narrowing in on women in policy, as well as the research and projects pertaining to improving the mental health landscape in this area. So directly to the question, if I'm a listener, why should I care about this topic and what is in it for me as a listener? And directly to you, Dr. Melser Brody.
Women's mental health impacts all of us. And for anyone who's a listener, and particularly for women, the need to pay attention to your mental health is critical. We know that women suffer from depression at twice the rate of men. We know that the perinatal time, pregnancy, and the year thereafter is one of the greatest times of risk for a depressive episode. And we know that women have mental health concerns over their lifespan at a much higher frequency than men. Unfortunately, it's often been neglected and people do not receive the treatment they need and are often underdiagnosed and undertreated. And so for all of these reasons, particularly now with the national mental health crisis and an increased awareness, particularly around maternal mental health, it's so important that for all listeners, people spend a little bit of time thinking about how they're doing and making sure they're bringing this to attention with themselves and their families.
Samantha, maybe add something to a ray of hope. Your fundamental work recently in trying to identify new treatments, especially for postpartum depression, maybe talk a little about that so people understand that there is real hope on the horizon or even here now, and we should actually capitalize on the benefits from this.
Absolutely. Okay. So one of the things that's very encouraging is that there has been a sea change over the last several years around increased awareness for women's mental health, particularly increased awareness around the importance of paying attention to maternal mental health. And we now have a new class of drug. The first FDA-approved drug for postpartum depression was approved in 2019. This was a huge step forward. It is a novel drug. It's called brexanolone. And it has an entirely new mechanism of action or the way it works as the first drug specifically designed and approved for postpartum depression that has rapid onset of action. So this drug will work, and you see it working within 24 hours of what is a 60-hour treatment. This has been a major step forward in terms of, one, changing the way we think about treating depression, that you can have something that works quickly. And secondly, that you have a time limited duration of treatment. In this particular drug, you take it for 60 hours and it's an IV drug. And then symptoms have been sustained in the clinical trials at least a month out, and some of the other studies longer than that. Also, right now it's very timely because an oral drug called zuranolone, which is a first cousin to brexanolone, and is being evaluated by the FDA. They're expecting a decision later this week. Both of these drugs have been developed to be novel treatments that are fast acting. Zuranolone is an oral drug, certainly much more convenient. That is a 2-week course of treatment with rapid onset of action within the first few days. So both of these drugs are very, very hopeful in terms of how we're thinking about treating depression and depression quickly, and also for a time limited period that will really change the landscape.
And I think to add to it, to the progress from science in terms of new treatments now, coupled with really getting policy changes and community engagement, is why I think I'm excited, Samantha, you agreed to join us on this podcast today, because one alone is not actually solving the problem. We have to have new treatments, but then we need to have community engaged and policymakers to really pay attention to it if we are going to bend the curve.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that's very interesting is that having effective treatments often pushes policy forward. Interestingly, when you have very complex problems without any great solutions, you often have what can be stagnation in terms of we don't know what to do about it, and it seems like such a hopeless situation, we're not going to do much about it. But when you have the opportunity to intervene in meaningful ways that really can move the bar, oftentimes policy follows that. And so it's taken, as you know, a solid 25 years to have the attention paid to women's mental health, particularly maternal mental health. We know that maternal mental health affects conservatively 1 in 8 mothers. And we know that it's the greatest cause when not treated of maternal suicide, and also, you know, significant morbidity that crosses across 2 generations. So it took 25 years to have this be something that had great awareness, and to have routine screening happen broadly, along with, as you well know, and you've played a huge role in this, just screening for depression in primary care outside of the perinatal period. And now that there's an FDA-approved treatment or treatments that could intervene quickly, I think that this will hopefully accelerate the need to screen. And then for our colleagues in other parts of medicine outside of mental health, how we can address this in very effective ways, I think will hopefully increase enthusiasm for digging in at the policy level.
And we're talking about women in policy today. So clearly, you know, perinatal mental illness is one of the ACEs, the adverse childhood experience. So as an investigator, can you tell us more, both of you, this is for both of you, so our listeners know why, you know, what this means, why it's important, why all of this topic is so central and paramount to them?
There is no question that there is no health without mental health. And our policies have to move the bar so that we give each person the best chance of doing well and thriving. For our families, mothers, and for women who play a linchpin in often caretaking of children and are still disproportionately caretakers, taking care of mothers ensures that the next generation will have the best chance of doing well. So it really is an investment in the health of any society. And obviously for you know, fathers and men as well, you know, equally important. But the issue has been that women's mental health has been neglected, and maternal mental health in particular has been neglected. So policy that sees this period of time as important and invests resources in protecting mothers and their mental health, as well as just their physical health, is critically important to have the adequate funding available to do good.
And we've known this for 20 years, that the mental health of youths, like teenagers, is very negatively affected if the mother has depression. And in fact, we published on it where you can actually improve the outcome for mothers with depression and have a positive impact on youth. So I think there is extended evidence that this, in neglecting maternal health, has impact not only for the mother, but for the entire family, and especially for children. And if you want to design a early life trauma experiment, you would see some youth with a mother who has extensive depression, because that really is traumatic for the child. And one way to address it is obviously address the child's mental health, but also take care of the mother's mental health.
That's really good. Can you say that last part one more time, Dr. Trivedi? How the connection between mother and youth.
So when we published this 20 years back, that when mothers have depression, their teenage children have symptoms of depression and anxiety. And if you treat the depression in the mother successfully, it has positive outcomes, not only for the mother, but also for the teenage child that these mothers have. So I think that there is extensive evidence showing that there is real need to not neglect the maternal health.
Absolutely. Well, and we know the CDRC is our group and the CDC research found out that 45% of high school students said they were consistently sad and hopeless, leading to a loss of desire to participate in normal activities. So due to this growing mental health crisis, because I know we were talking earlier about how that word crisis has been stated a lot recently, Dr. Meltzer Brody, you have been very active in applying research to policy and are really leading a multi-pronged approach like Dr. Trivedi mentioned earlier. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. One of the things that's been interesting to watch is that the mental health crisis that we face now did not fall out of the sky in one day. It's been brewing for a very long time. And the COVID pandemic in many ways just was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back in terms of increasing prevalence a bit more and frankly, just saturating the infrastructure that was already weakened. So what that means is that people can't find mental health professionals. And many more people are suffering with mental health conditions than there are available people to take care of them, along with the complexities of reimbursement and how you can have access to care that would be covered by both public or private health insurance. So we have seen the collapse of the mental health infrastructure, and this coming at a particularly bad time. In the child and adolescent mental health arena, it's been underfunded, profoundly underfunded for years. This is not new news, not even remotely. It's just that the COVID pandemic and all the societal disruptions has worsened child and adolescent mental health so profoundly that it's now in everyone's house. No one is really going by that's not impacted in some way. This is obviously directly connected to the mental health of mothers and fathers and families who certainly live in the house with their kids. And so the maternal mental health piece is critical. One, the relationship, as Dr. Trivedi said, between a mother's mental health and how the infant will do in terms of long-term development is well documented. So it's the best start for any mother and her baby to have mom doing well. But further, for many women, the perinatal period leads to onset of mental health conditions that, if not adequately treated, can become chronic over time. And then that just has long-lasting impacts on the child as well. The other thing is when children are not doing well, it puts an enormous stress on families. And so for all of these reasons, investing in multi-pronged approaches that are adequately resourced and funded so that families that are struggling can get help easily is paramount. And this requires multiple policy changes. How we reach kids, programs from the earliest sort of moment, adequate screening and referral and embedded care, collaborative care models within pediatrics, increasing mental health services in schools, engaging anyone involved in the care of women to have adequate and, you know, multifaceted mental health resources, but it requires an entirely different way of looking at it than we've done before. It cannot be siloed. It has to be integrated. There's multiple examples and evidence-based examples of things that work that, frankly, we just have not invested in as a society. And I think that the time is now to make real change.
And I think this is creating a situation where we have an opportunity. We have often, most often in this issue, really addressed it by being reactive. There's a mass shooting and we run to it. There's a suicide, we worry about it. And there is a crisis and we address it. Or we really have to think of this as comprehensively as possible. So therefore, at least our center, Samantha, is actually going into high schools and doing 5-session prevention programs that is the youth aware of mental health. We've now reached over 50,000 students around the state. The state legislature, thankfully, is actually funding us to train people across the state to go to high schools and do the prevention program, because you have to really start thinking of it as a full dimension and not only wait for a crisis to occur. We don't do that in medical illnesses. Why do we do that in mental health is beyond me. But at least we have to start thinking, as you rightly point out, in terms of prevention and early detection, because screening and early intervention that doesn't even require medications, for example. So our center, Samantha, is now focusing largely on 10 to 30-year-olds and trying to actually address it in a comprehensive manner, right from early detection, prevention, resilience building programs, going to high schools, going to undergraduate programs, and doing a comprehensive and a full population-based work rather than only wait for somebody when they're identified. And I think that often when somebody is identified, it's in a crisis, and it often, unfortunately, could be too late.
Absolutely. Well, that's incredibly wonderful to hear. And it is heartwarming. And one of the things that gives me great hope is that out of every crisis comes, as you mentioned, opportunity. And I do think there's been a major wake-up call, and we're seeing many states, and North Carolina is also thankfully moving in that direction, beginning to make significant investments. Certainly Texas has, as you mentioned. And the work that you and your center are doing is fantastic. We are engaged in a number of initiatives, and there is a huge outpouring of both the critical government support and funding, which you simply must have, as well as philanthropy and people who have suffered in their own life stories around these issues, who want to give back and change the trajectory for others. And so I do think it is an incredible opportunity to seize upon what has been enormous suffering with a collective action plan that we're all going to do better and do more and take a multi-pronged approach. But it's great to hear what your center is doing and the important impact that will have in your communities.
And at least in Texas, in addition to this prevention program, Samantha, the wonderful initiative that the state legislature through what is called the Texas Children's Mental Health Care Consortium is funding us to do a research network across all 12 medical schools in Texas called the Youth Depression Suicide Research Network. And we're beginning to actually publish our results on this, where we have almost 1,500 kids enrolled in this study, and we are going to follow them longitudinally like the Framingham study. It is that kind of longitudinal course that we will need to understand so that what works in January of 2019 may be different from what works in January of 2023. We have to begin to try to figure out what are the best treatments for any given individual at any given time. And I think that is the kind of work that is being possible, being made by this.
Yeah, which is truly wonderful. And it will take innovative approaches to figure out where we are now. And in particular, dealing with our youth, we have to meet them where they are. They're unbelievably digitally savvy. And the way that those of us who are seasoned are looking at the world is very different than where 18-year-olds look at the world or 25-year-olds look at the world. So that's why there's huge opportunities, and the models that will become available moving forward, how it resonates with the next generation to be engaged is going to be critical to determine. So the large-scale research you're talking about will make a tremendous difference. We are also thankfully in North Carolina moving in that direction. And at UNC, a new suicide prevention institute that's funded by philanthropy and is also partnering with other efforts across the state to really change the dialogue and partner with communities to change how we educate, prevent, and change care delivery. So the engagement broadly by so many is heartwarming. It is a nice thing to see. I mean, unfortunately, horrendous suffering to get to this place to make people wake up, but it is a moment of opportunity to do good.
And we should probably connect back, and we could possibly collect similar information across the two states and compare and learn from each other, because I
Absolutely.
Think an ongoing learning healthcare network kind of approach is really what is necessary, and we'll connect, obviously.
That would be fantastic. We'd love to do that.
Well, I want to thank you both for the work you're doing, making mental health a priority, and for illuminating so much insight on this topic. So to close out, two things. So I'm a storyteller at heart, and I'd love to hear if you have a story that you feel salient to our subject today to close out, and to let our listeners know where they can find you or reach out to do something about our topic today, and to leave everyone with a call to action.
I think that there is a tremendous opportunity now for people to dig in and get involved. So in the last few years, we have seen research that has led to novel treatments for depression that work differently, quickly, with a completely different mechanism of action that really changes the way we treat depression, that we are seeing an investment at the federal level, at state levels, in changing policy that are forward-thinking for women's mental health, for investment in child mental health. In North Carolina, in terms of a story, because of the dire situation and the children that were boarding in our emergency rooms in crisis, there's now a large-scale investment that the North Carolina General Assembly is discussing that would make a huge investment. We are opening a new child and adolescent psychiatric hospital in UNC in the next few months, which came about because of this crisis. And I think that the community engagement and investment and what we're seeing happening around the country is absolutely cause for hope. I think all of us have a role to play in digging in and advocating, and advocacy makes a big difference in keeping these issues top of mind. So I am hopeful about the future, but I cannot stress enough the amazing work that you see happening with your center and the leadership of Dr. Trivedi and others who have been pounding the pavement for a long time. So this is, I think, a really watershed moment, but I am very encouraged by what will happen next and look forward to seeing the positive changes.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this episode of Brainstorm, Decoding Depression, with your guide from the Center for Depression Research and Clinical Care. Be sure to follow us on social media at UTSW_CDRC so you don't miss any of our episode announcements or the episodes itself. If you have any suggestions for topics or questions you'd like answered, send us an email at decodingdepressionpodcast@utsouthwestern.edu. Thank you for listening. See you next time.